Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to episode number 45 of the Azure Podcast. It's going to be a very free-form roundtable discussion on a few new updates to Azure, which we thought our listeners would enjoy. My name is Sujit Mello. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft in the app dev space. And on Skype with me, I have my two esteemed colleagues, Kale and Evan. Guys?
Hey, this is Kale. I'm a consultant with Microsoft as well in the New York, New Jersey region, and I specialize in app dev and Azure development as well.
And my name is Evan Vasilik, and I'm a support escalation engineer on the Windows team supporting Windows on Azure scenarios and Azure networking.
So it's nice to have the three of us together again. It's been a
while. Yeah, it's been a while.
It's always been something or other. We've had guests on. Somebody, one of us hasn't been able to make it.
That vacation and
things, you know. Some people go to Dallas to have some fun. But it's all good. Glad we're all back here. I was actually, you know, Kale and I were in Dallas together, and I was quite surprised to see that, you know, people actually still wear those cowboy hats and boots and whatnot.
Oh,
over there.
Yes. Yes, they do.
I was not expecting that for some reason, but glad to see the tradition lives on over there.
Yes. We gotta be careful, right? We can't be too rough on Texas because they'll come find us.
Yes, absolutely. So, this is, today's we had actually had a guest lined up for today, and she couldn't make it at the last minute due to an emergency. So we'll get her on another time. But luckily enough, we had a few recent updates to Azure that we thought we could just discuss today because they were fairly important updates. Let's see, guys, which one do you think we should start with? We had a few listed on the show notes. Which one do you think we should go with first?
I think we should go with the new VMs. I mean, that's really different than some of the other stuff.
I totally agree with you. Evan, you want to take that one?
This is your area. Sure. Although I knew they were coming, but I was actually surprised when they actually went, I think they actually went GA like the day of, right? Or are they in preview? I'll have to go back and check.
I think the standard one is available right now, but not the basic, I think, right?
Yeah, that might be the difference. But, like, I was really surprised to see him pop out, right, like that as right away. Yeah. These are what we're calling our D series. Clearly, somewhere I'm not sure where the D comes from unless it's from the SSD. But these are up to 112 gigs in memory. Higher, faster compute processors. So basically higher clock speed. And then probably the thing that will get most people's attention is the 800 gigabytes of local SSD storage.
Which is the maximum, one that's available, the maximum SKU, right?
I mean, they range from, obviously all the way down to, I think there's one that's 50.
Yeah.
But you can go, you know, if you really want to go full bore, right, you can go all the way up to that point. And it looks like, you know, we do have a range of, just like other stuff, we got a range of cores and a mixing and matching of CPUs and how much memory do you want. You know, do you want more memory but less cores? Do you want more memory and more cores? It looks like we got all the way up to 16-core machines. And then, there is, obviously, this is a consumption-based business. They are, you know, more expensive than the other ones. But, I think if you need the – if you need the resources, you need it. And being able to offer this is a great thing, I think, for the customers that actually need it.
Okay. And that's one thing I wanted to just quickly discuss with you guys today. Like, now we have these, I think we had the A series before, correct?
Yeah.
A for Apple, and now we have D for disk, I suppose. Those are the two letters that we have the series. So why, obviously the D series is a lot more expensive, but what should be going through someone's mind before they decide to jump in on the D series as opposed to the A series? Is it primarily the IO latency or IO bound applications? Are those the ones that you want to run on the D series?
Yeah, there's really two of them, right? I mean, that's definitely one of them. But we have seen some customers who've come in, and we saw this in SQL Server back when I was on the SQL Server team, where if you're a extremely compute driven operation, and your operations are lots and lots of really little things, right? I mean, think about conceptually adding two numbers together. Right? Mm-hmm. That's not really an intensive CPU process. And if you're doing that on a per cycle basis, you actually get less cycles per minute when you have a slower clock speed.
Mm.
So by going to the faster clock speed, right, if you have something that's compute intensive, you will get a bump just from that piece. Now, I don't know how much more you – I mean, you have to be a real kind of specialized workload to really take huge advantage of this.
Right.
If you need it, you need it, right? So it certainly offers the opportunities there. I mean, do you guys see – I mean, because you guys are on the app development side of the house. I mean, do you guys see workloads out there where people are actually really looking for, faster clock speeds on a given – machine when they're buying a machine? Does that normally come into the conversation?
I mean, I don't know about Kale, but what I've seen it being used as, customer builds an application. The application is not necessarily scalable. You cannot scale out very well, but they can scale up, obviously, right? That's always an easy thing to do.
Yep.
And that's why they often, will go for the higher CPU models just so that they can scale up in the application. And to be honest, I don't necessarily agree with that strategy. I think, you need to redo the application and make it scale out to infinity if possible, and use all the lower commodity hardware in the process. But I believe that's what I have seen. Kale, what have you seen in that area?
Yeah, I mean, most of the things I've worked with, people kind of fall in the middle. Right, they're not using the lowest ones or maybe just for a test or something, but usually around the middle of the road. I don't see people much generally on the really super high-end ones, but maybe it's just the people I know are not using those. And to some point, it's if you start to get to that level, maybe it's time to think about some of our PaaS offerings and stuff that can scale a little better on that side. But that's just my two cents on it.
But, I mean, I guess my question was, have you guys ever seen – I mean, obviously there's some people that say, I just need that last little bit because I just can't – I can't re-architect, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, in Azure, right, we're infinitely not only do we have some of the technologies for PaaS to do infinitely scalable, but if you decide you've over-provisioned or under-provisioned, right, you can very easily just change your size, right? It's not like you're stuck with, hey, I bought this hardware – a couple of years ago, and I'm just stuck with it. I oversized it. But in the on-premises world, I guess that's kind of where I'm just looking for the comparison. Do you guys, other than people looking for that last little bump, have you ever run into people even in the on-prem world that are, when they spec their machine, they're saying, hey, I absolutely need the faster clock speed, but versus, hey, I just want more cores?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, G.
Yeah, the faster clock speed especially comes into play when you've got CPU-intensive applications, things that reporting, the reporting servers, or if you are doing any big data kind of processing, that's when the clock speed makes a big difference.
So those kind of workloads, they're not driven by number of cores. I mean, obviously that's a factor, but that alone isn't enough to...
Right. It's the raw speed, that's important in some cases.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, that certainly makes sense, right? I mean, I think I agree with Kale. I mean, if I had to recommend it to somebody, I'd never say go to the Ds just for the clock speed, because I think there's better ways to do it. But if you need it, you need it. What do you guys think of the IO aspect of this?
In my experience with the on-prem is people buy the biggest that they can at that time. So
yeah.
When they're buying new hardware, they'll just say, whatever's the maximum right now, I'll just buy that because in 3 years it's going to be ready to leave. And so that's what my
– Because I have purchase order and budget money burning a hole in my pocket right now.
Yeah, so I had a question about the storage behind these, Evan, because there's a lot of information about these being solid-state drives or solid-state disks. And so is it not blob storage that these things are running on? Are these a different type of disk, or how does that work?
Yeah, so these are actually and if you look at – you got to look at it carefully, right, because – you know, there's obviously lots of people that want all of our storage to be this way. But it's the local disk is the SSD, right? So that that transient local-only disk that we've talked about in the past is the one where you're getting your super speed bump. So you actually have to be really, I think, cautious about what you actually do on it. Because if you get a failover in the middle, right, something you've written there and not persisted somewhere else is truly gone.
So essentially if someone said, hey, I'm going to use these D-series because they're faster and they have SSDs for something maybe like SQL Server, which is typically I.O. bound, and they go and create a bunch of data disks, they're not really getting benefit.
Well, I mean, they will some, right? Because you can certainly, like, if you put your so SQL Servers, now I can go all SQL Server geek. So, you know, SQL Server's got its tempdb, right? And the tempdb is basically where it does all of its sorting operations and all the things that it, you know, might do in memory, but then sometimes has to persist to disk for, you know, any number of reasons. If you were to put your tempdb on the SSD, you would see an impact if your workload is such that you would be doing a lot of reads and writes to tempdb. But yeah, your data disks, you know, the raw in and out of your data disk is not going to see any improvement there, but your memory swap file is also on that disk, right? So, and this is, I actually don't know because SSDs were just coming along when I left the SQL Server team, but you know, obviously RAM is a lot faster than a normal drive. I mean, I'm sure it's a little faster than SSDs because it's not local, right? SSDs aren't local. But do you guys know what the difference is in access speed between an SSD and RAM?
Oh, it just magnitudes, right? That's where that hackathon stuff that we were working on in 2014 came, right? So you can pin a table into memory.
Okay. But it's still got to be way faster than a traditional hard drive.
Right? Yeah, definitely.
You are going to get a bump there. Mm-hmm.
The memory cards are typically on the bus, right, of the CPU, of the motherboard.
Right.
So those are, what about 16-bit, 32-bit buses, whereas the SSDs are on a serial ATA interface.
They're still
throttled by that in some way.
Okay.
All you're doing is you're taking away the seek time off the traditional disk,
right?
Which is what slows him down sometimes,
right? At the end of the day, I mean, I think it'd be interesting to really kind of go try. I don't know any workloads off the top of my head that are going to just automatically run better if you do this, but I can certainly envision some that will be, and I'm sure they're SQL Server type.
So this is I'm glad we're talking about this because this is going to be a source of confusion for a while. So if I get a typical D1, let's take a D1, okay, which is the lowest of the standard tier that we offer today. And I just want to throw some prices out there so that people know this is not, you know, real cheap. But the D1 is the lowest. It has one core, 3.5 gigabytes of RAM, 50 GB of SSD storage, and it costs $127 a month to run. Okay. So if you have, I mean, just to, you know, just so you guys know that if you're using your traditional MSDN account, that's almost the entire credit that you have for the whole month, okay, to run one D1. On the other hand, you know, if you run a traditional A1, I suppose, I think I have a A1 or A2 maybe VMs lying around. And those, I think they cost like $20 or so a month. You know, this is sort of the difference. But if you get a D1, the operating system is going to be on blob storage, correct?
Correct.
And this 50 GB is the D drive typically that's assigned to you when you boot up.
Yep.
And that's transient. When you reboot again, everything's gone. It all starts fresh.
Well, when you change hosts, right. But, I mean, conceptually, yeah. I mean, you really ought to think about it as not persistent through reboots.
Right. There's no guarantee that it's going to be after your reboot.
Yeah.
So in those scenarios, it would have to be an application, right, that does require a lot of temporary space to run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the kind of application that's going to take advantage of these SSDs. I hope our listeners are not thinking that the OS itself is going to boot from SSD. And, you know, I mean, and that's typically what we do, right? If I were to, when I want to speed up my computer at home, what I do is I put an SSD on the boot drive, right? Mm-hmm. And typically your second drive is the slower drive, you know, the normal, the spindle drive, where you have all your files, media files, et cetera, and whatnot. But your boot drive is a smaller drive, and that's the SSD. This is kind of the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it, and actually I'm looking at some more of the documentation on it, and we may actually have to, at some point we may want to revisit this and pull in somebody from SQL Server, because it looks like in SQL 2014 we actually introduced a feature called buffer pool extensions. And the buffer pool in SQL is what I was talking about. That's the big, big chunk of memory that SQL Server stores all the data. It reads off of disk, so it doesn't have to go back and forth to disk as often. We actually introduced an extension where that stuff gets can get swapped out and knows and is smart enough to take advantage of the benefits of SSDs.
Okay.
So, yeah, so this is definitely, I mean, I don't know that I want to say that this is only targeted at SQL Server, but there's clearly a synergistic thing here, right? We made some changes in SQL Server 2014 to take advantage of a scenario like this, and wow, go figure. Now we have the physical capability.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some people are going to put SQL Server on these. It does make a lot of sense. But if you look at the range of servers that they have, right, they're from D1 through D14, okay, and some of them are not, they're not all sequentially used.
Right.
But the lower ones, D1 through D4, are general purpose, they say, for websites, small and medium databases, and everyday applications, as they call it. And then the more memory intensive ones are the D11s through the D14s, where they're, you know, for running full SharePoint server farms and high throughput applications. The cost differential is quite wide. I mean, I mentioned the $127 a month for the D1. The D14, which is 16 cores, 112 GB of RAM, and as you mentioned, I have an 800 GB of storage, of SSD storage. That's $1,943 a month. Okay. So that's, you'd have to, you know, that's got to be, I mean,
it says
SharePoint over here. I mean, I just hope that, you know, like SharePoint, what are you going to use the 800 GB for? I mean, that's, I'm just struggling a little bit on that here. If it's all transient storage, how much transient storage do you need?
Yeah, I don't know SharePoint well enough to know. I know web apps in general, right? They can have a pretty decent sized footprint in RAM,
mm-hmm.
And so your SWAT file, right? They'll be impacted by that. They would certainly get a nice bump from this, but I don't know if SharePoint itself is known for very high memory requirements. I mean, I know it can certainly I know if you're trying to install SharePoint 2013 on a machine that doesn't have enough RAM, it will block you.
Right.
I think the minimum is like 4 or something like that. But yeah, I mean, it would be really interesting to, as people start to deploy this, to see like what kind of bumps they're seeing. I also, and again, I have absolutely no prior special internal knowledge of this, but do you think there's some SKUs in between 4 and 11?
I'm sure there are some spots. Yeah, for future expansion.
Yeah.
I think the other thing too to consider, especially with these bigger SKUs, but I don't think it's different from the A's or the D's, is the core limits. If by default, I think our core limit per subscription is like 20, right?
Yeah, it is.
So I mean, if you stood up a 16, I mean, you couldn't stand up two of them, without calling support and having them raise your limit. But
yeah, I'd make that call pretty early on in your planning process if you think you're going to need to do one of these. You wouldn't want to find it out the day you try and scale up your application, like, you know, the day you go live or something like that. Right. No, yeah, I mean, I think that, again, it's like everything else. I mean, I'm sure there's a class of customers that are just salivating over this, right? It'll be interesting to see what they actually do in the real world and see what the benefits is as they kind of balance that cost, right? That's like $2,000 a month against the benefits they're getting. Right. Yep. Will they stay there or will they, you know, change it or what? I don't know.
Right. They don't mention one more use case for these is running things like MongoDB and whatnot. I suppose those databases, they get loaded when you start them up. They load them into memory onto the SSD and probably persist them to the persistent storage when they shut down.
Yeah, MongoDB is it's a memory mapped file database. You're right. It would take advantage of the faster swap file.
Yeah.
Right. So while still maintaining your persistence. So yeah, that's probably a pretty good scenario as well. That makes sense. But I do think it is a little bit interesting where it's for general purpose for talking about D1 through D4. I'm looking on the website. Small to medium databases and other everyday applications. I don't know that I personally would call everyday application something that I need to go spec an SSD. that's just me, but you know. It's a neat functionality, right? It's nice to see us starting to surface some of the hardware options as well as all these different software and feature and application options we've had.
Yeah.
Where you really have that flexibility. But yeah, definitely keep in mind your per month cost. That'd be one heck of a bill to get accidentally.
Yes, I would definitely. If you're experimenting with Azure, I wouldn't jump into the D series just yet. you'll use up your free credits very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think that's anything else you guys want to add on this topic before we move on to the next?
No, I don't. I think I'm good.
Yeah, I think we'll revisit it in the future once we get some data on it.
Yep, good idea. I know there was some discussion about the IOPS and whatnot, right, of these SSDs, and we'll probably, when we get some hard numbers, we can discuss that later.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. I suppose the next interesting bit of news that came up recently, I mean, I'm not exactly sure which date this happened, but our own Mark Russinovich, who was a technical fellow in the Azure team, is that his previous title?
I think so, yeah.
And he is now the CTO of Azure. Okay, that's his new title. Chief Technology Officer of Azure. And, initially when I saw this, I was like, CTO. I mean, that's an odd designation to have for the Azure team. But then, you know, I was thinking about, I mean, Azure, if you think about it, is essentially a number of various data centers that are being managed by that one team, okay, the Azure team. And, you know, in most companies, if they have a couple of data centers, you know, they have a CTO, right, who kind of manages all the hardware, software, the procedures, et cetera, that go into those data centers. The number of data centers we have, I suppose we need a CTO, right?
Yeah. I mean, what are we – I can't remember the count now, but, I mean, any one of our data centers is bigger than most companies.
Most companies, exactly.
And we have, what, 8, 10 of them, something like that now?
All over the world? I thought we had some. I thought we had more.
Oh yeah. Well, I guess it depends on. Yeah. I forget what the exact Azure count, but you know, I guess if you include all the other ones we've got as well, right, for some of the internal stuff, yeah, we've got way more than that.
Yeah. Now, he's not the. Who's the president of the unit? Is that?
I think that's Scott.
That's still got Scott Guthrie.
Okay. I think. Let's see. Let's actually pull this up here and see.
Yeah, I think he's the CVP of Azure and Enterprise, and then Azure falls under it.
Oh, so yeah. So actually, it's interesting. Mark is reporting up through the development side of the org, But he's one step removed from Scott. There's somebody in between them, but that's still, I mean, it's still incredibly influential position.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we talked about this before when he moved into the Azure team, right? To see somebody of that kind of stature and impact want to jump into this space and then now start really putting himself in a position where he's got that influence. I mean, it kind of reinforces how serious we are.
Yeah, and I think that's the right position for him. I wouldn't want anybody else as CTO of Azure, to be honest with you. So I'm glad he's taken over those reins. He hasn't announced any change or anything like that, right? It's just a change of designation so far. There's no other known changes that were announced, were they?
Not that I've seen, but you know.
Okay. Well, we'll have to. I guess when we're done with 1,000 episodes, maybe he'll give us the time of the day and come on our show. I don't know. We'll have to see if that ever happens. it's just an interesting piece of news in the Azure space.
Yeah.
All right. Which topic, Kale, you pick one. Which one do you want to pick up next?
Yeah, just a real quick update was the Redis cache. I think we talked about in a couple podcasts ago and a few times actually when we talked about caching, but the Redis cache is now GA this week. I think I just got that notification yesterday, the public notification, so we have that available now. You know, as the normal strategy, we have a bunch of different cache solutions up there.
Mm-hmm.
Redis cache is one of the newest, but we had our hosted cache, and then we had the way you could do the in-role caching, and all that stuff still works. Nothing's being removed there, but the recommendation is to, if it's something new and you haven't done your caching stuff yet, is to look at Redis cache as what you should be using going forward.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the nice things, Redis cache. It comes in this basic, which is a single node infrastructure, and then the standard, which is a multiple node, right? Two node, is that a primary backup? Is that how they use it? Master slave mode?
Yeah, they don't have a clustering capability, at least the one that we have yet. And I'm pretty sure the open source doesn't have that yet. It's something they're working on, but the clustering support will come.
Okay. So, but right now you can, if you want the full failover, you want to go for the standard option, which has the two nodes, that kind of back each other up.
Yep.
Okay. And, I wonder how difficult would it be for, I guess a lot of our customers, maybe our listeners, maybe using the older shared, caching infrastructure that we have. Well, when I say older, it's still supported, right? For a while.
I think it's deprecated, but we are. I mean, we will support it for a long time.
We'll support it for a long time, yeah.
Yep.
And then,
yeah.
And then there's, I was looking online. There's some steps on how customers can migrate over to the new Redis cache.
It's pretty straightforward for if you're using. So if you came from one of our other cache offerings, it's really straightforward because the way that we stored stuff before was essentially like a hash table, but the key value pair, right? And so you built your data structures if you wanted to build it differently to put it in there, but it was essentially key value store. Redis brings along a bunch of other things. So it can still do key value, which makes it easy to migrate, but you can also, it has its own data structures inside, so you can use those so you don't have to build stuff in there and still take advantage of all the caching. So that's kind of one of the benefits of Redis.
Okay. But from an application perspective, there will be changes involved, right, if you switch to Redis?
Yeah, minor. It's not a big change.
Okay. Now, as you said, the key value pairs are still there, just probably the API may have changed a bit.
Yep.
Great. Okay, that's a good one. And then let's see, the last thing that we want to talk about, maybe a couple of more things here, the Microsoft Trust Center. Yeah. So we had some discussions internally about, if a customer is about to go live on Azure and they think that they want to do a penetration test, right, to make sure all their servers are hardened to the right level, et cetera, should they just go ahead and do that?
if they want to find it exactly out, if they want to find out exactly how secure we are, probably. Gee, if you're attacked, you, yeah, we'll protect ourselves and protect you. Yeah, I actually know, so I know the team that handles these when they come in, and they actually, you know, should open up a support case, and there's a form that you fill out saying what you're doing and when, you know, and how you're going to do it. And then, because otherwise our automated systems will kick in.
And they will typically just shut down the port or the entry point. Is that what happens?
Yeah, I don't know how. I know I've actually seen some because, true story, I actually got caught up in one of these once. I had a VM that I created a new VM and the VIP had been owned by somebody else either the day before or earlier in the day. And that somebody else was doing something bad. And then I got a little nasty gram from some of my internal colleagues, and they shut the hosted service down.
Wow.
And, you know, I had to go, you know, it was really kind of interesting because I know the guy that was running the program at the time, and he's actually here in the office with me, and I walked over and was like, you know, I didn't do anything. I think you guys have a false positive here. And then we went and looked at it, and he's like, oh, yeah, it was yesterday's person. You just happen to own it now. You certainly want to let us know so that you don't have that kind of unexpected downtime to your service as you're doing it.
Okay. And, Siji, maybe just explain a little bit for those maybe that don't do this a lot or whatever, the penetration testing. Are we talking about something where it's trying to, like, find open port? What does that mean, like, as far as this, and why would it shut us down? Is it hitting some sort of throttle or something, or what is this?
Well, they'll try and ping various ports, right, on the thing, and even the existing ports that are open, they'll try to hack passwords. And whatnot. I mean, that's typically, I believe, what they do in a penetration test. There's companies that do that. You know, they typically will hire an outside company. I used to know of a company called Foundstone, out in California that used to do that. I forget one of the, antivirus vendors bought them out. I forget which one. But, that's what they do. You know, they have a team of people that they have an automated suite that they'll just turn it on your, endpoints, and they'll try all various combinations of known vulnerabilities to first detect what you've got. They try to detect what kind of servers you have in the back there, and then B, take advantage of that detection and see if there's any vulnerabilities that can be exposed over there.
Yeah, so I think this is important because, so someone from a developer side or even from the IT side may say, you know, we're comfortable with Azure. We've, you know, done our due diligence. We've researched to make sure that, you know, the way the data is being stored and encrypted and handled in Azure meets all of our needs. But typically, this is my experience, and this was not working for Microsoft, even outside of Microsoft. What happens in these scenarios is there's a security team that maybe is led by someone like the CTO who does it unbeknownst to the IT staff to say, I want to understand, you know, what our vulnerabilities are. My IT staff is saying this. And that's why, to your point, it's a third-party thing. They'll go out and say, hey, try to get into our network without it. I'm not even going to tell IT because I want to see what kind of vulnerabilities. I don't want them prepping anything.
Right.
And, you know, when you get into these cloud services, they need to be aware of this, that they could bring things down. You know?
Exactly, yeah. That's one thing. And the other thing that they do more often than not is to try to simulate a denial-of-service attack, right? And I think that's what Evan was saying. They need to know about that it's an expected attack and not something that's being caused at that time by some other party.
Yeah, because actually if you look out at the Trust Center, one of the questions is, you know, how does Microsoft or how does Azure protect itself against denial of services? And, you know, we do react and we will throttle down things and we will – you know, block access to things. So, you know, the services are scalable. Our services are scalable enough to handle it. But, you know, you definitely don't want to get yourself DOS'd, and because in that case, we would kick in to protect you. But yeah, you want to be able to survive it, but you don't want it to. You want to let us know that you're doing it intentionally, so that you get a real test, right?
Yep. Okay. So the bottom line is that they should open up a support ticket.
Yeah, you could, and actually, a little tip here, you actually don't need to open up a technical support ticket. We consider that to be basically, you know, free support. You're just telling us you're going to do it, so we, you know, kind of know how to respond. So that actually you don't even need to have a support contract with us to do it. You just open up a billing / subscription ticket, and those folks should be able to help you out.
But you do that from your portal account, correct?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. You've got two options, right? It's, you know, one's a billing subscription and one's a technical. Mm-hmm. And you only have technical if you've purchased.
Got it.
Support. So, yeah, don't think you have to buy a subscription just to go do this testing.
I was about to ask that. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I guess I had one other question about security, and this is just a question. I don't know the answer to this, and maybe you guys do or don't. Something that used to happen, you know, when you're running your own data center is, things like mail used to cause this, typically. So somebody in the organization would decide that they want to run a mass mailing campaign out of the data center without letting IT know or anybody else know, and then you end up getting blacklisted by somebody like AT&T or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that's handled in Azure. Is there, if we get blacklisted, if a customer, do we protect before a customer would get blacklisted?
My experience has been, because I've seen some of the threads on this where we've had a customer said, hey, I got blacklisted. I think actually in this case it was a very similar situation I was talking about where the IP had gotten blacklisted, right? Because
yep.
We don't blacklist people, we blacklist IPs.
Yep.
And then this customer ended up with that IP, right? Even though they didn't own it before.
Yep.
I want to say in that case, we kind of coordinated with the customer to reach out to the, I guess there's companies that maintain these lists.
Yep.
of bad actors.
Yeah. It's hard to get off those lists too when you get on. That's why I wondered, like,
yeah,
you have to have a lot of power to get off this.
Yeah. I don't know how successful they were at doing that, but I know we were kind of partnering up with them to go back and say, yeah, you know, they did not own this, you know, thing a few days ago or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think that's the big challenge, right? I mean, there's these lists somewhere that are maintained, right? And if you end up on it, your ability to get off it is, you know, only limited so much as those people will talk to you.
Wow, yeah, I hate to be having those kind of discussions.
Yeah, I would delete my hosted service and recreate and get a new bit.
There you go. A little insight tip there.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't bother fighting it. Just roll with it. Get a new VIP.
Okay, cool. So, Kale, I noticed you put something down on SQL Server, always on. What was that all about?
Did I?
Did I put that? that was you? Sorry.
Yeah, that was me. Yeah, basically just two things that caught my attention the last couple of weeks. One of them is that, you know, we've got the resource groups now, our resource manager capability in the preview portal, which means you can create these templates, multi-server templates. And so we actually published one for SQL Server Always On. And the benefit to that is you now have a optimally configured SQL Server Always On, which is pretty cool because people not only struggle a little bit with getting the disks and everything out, but getting the listener configured and all that can be challenging. That's non-trivial just anywhere, much less adding the Azure stuff on it. And then the other thing, and I'll give a shout out to one of my teammates, Will Effinger, who actually we had on this podcast, you know, a while back talking about Windows Azure Backup. He collaborated with some of the guys on the Always On support team, and they basically put together this exhaustive list of, if you're going to do Always On in Azure, here's everything you need to know, right? Kind of an index of all these other resources,
okay.
As well as some call outs of some things that, you know, people tend to get tripped up on.
Remind us, so who was that?
That was Will Effinger.
Will, okay. Yep.
Way back.
Yep, I think you and Will were chatting. I remember, I think you guys
yeah.
did that alone.
Yep. He and some guys on the Always On team, you know, put that together, and, you know, we've already been sending it out left and right because it's a great, you know, summary of all those issues you can run into.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I think that was quite a lively discussion. Thanks, guys. it went on for longer than I thought it would, so hopefully listeners still with us over here. Anyways, next week we'll have another guest on, and we'll be back to, you know, we're trying to get a mix of having some people, some specialists from the different areas on our show do talk about different areas of Azure, as well as you know, some just general roundtable discussions like this, just to mix it up a little bit. So hopefully the folks like this these various formats. All right, guys, thanks again for having you guys on the podcast, and I'll see you next week.
Yeah, always fun. See you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.